The following audio was recorded at the Pacific School Leadership Institute, which was held October 24 and 25, 2019, in Spokane, Washington.
Welcome to the panel discussion, PSLI 2019. We have some willing brethren here to help us out in some discussion, and we have a number of, actually quite a few questions, probably some of them we won't cover. I'd like to ask them now to go ahead and come forward, take a seat here, wherever you would like. Whoever gets here first, take your seat. Make yourselves comfortable. I do ask that you try to hold the mic close to your mouth so everyone can hear. And sorry, there's not a little more room there on the table. Thank you. We have with us Ernie Ressler, and you are from Bangor, California, is that correct? James Beachy, Estacada, Oregon. Malin Zare, is it Walla Walla? Or Milton Freewater, Oregon. And Gerald Miller from Pennsylvania. I'm going to start out with one question I would like them to answer. They are all going to answer the same question in approximately 60 seconds. The question is this: why should I support the Christian Day School movement? Ernie.
It is the best and most successful way of passing on the faith and the best way of teaching social skills that will serve us and our children well in brotherhood relationships. For our children to learn that the vision is being promoted on a larger scale than just the parents is invaluable.
Thank you. Brother James?
Ernie just put into a more wordy thing exactly what I was thinking is the best way to pass on the Christian faith and be an inspiration to students to do the same thing to their children and their children and their children.
Thank you. Brother Malin?
Well, I guess the way it formed in my mind is it our single most powerful tool for shaping the church of tomorrow, which is, again, saying more or less the same thing. I believe Brother Gerald said yesterday that he's heard preachers tell their teachers that you have more influence in the church than I do. That was me. I don't know. Actually, I told Mr. John that just a couple weeks ago in a text message. We were having a debate about something. It's all his fault. No, and so I would say, as a preacher, I feel like sometimes I have the least amount of influence. Sometimes I feel like the church is like concrete. It's poured by the parents, shaped by the teachers, and we preachers get to polish what's there.
Very interesting. Thank you, Gerald.
Well, I see it as the as one of the hopes, the future of our churches, as I've been saying. And I would say another reason to support it is that there is a long history of Christian school education. So we're a part of something that's several thousand years old, which makes it worthwhile and I think validates it. As a parent, I would say that I support the Christian school movement because I don't have enough wherewithal to raise my children by myself. Or my wife and I need the church through the school to help me. So the teachers can extend what the teaching of my home offers and are able to plug the holes in my parenting and my approaches and my ways. So I need the brotherhood because as a dad, I don't have enough. I need the school.
All right. So on the same question, I would like to challenge you a little bit. Is it possible then to overemphasize schools? Any of you? Can we emphasize schools and lose something else that we should be focusing on?
If we're going to only emphasize one aspect of the school, we can overemphasize it. But if we're going to take the whole picture where we're dealing with the church and the parents and the community, that's all we have to talk about. So So it's hard to say he's overemphasizing the school when we're talking about the whole community.
Okay, if we include the whole community. All right, any other thoughts on that? Okay, in line with that a little bit, let's just talk a little bit about homeschooling. Do we know, can any of you tell me, why some of, let's say in the 60s and 70s, or our forefathers, why did they choose church school instead of homeschooling? Why didn't they just support parents homeschooling? Now, I'm not asking you to make any critical statements of homeschooling. We're not opposed to that here. But was there a reason in particular, and perhaps it's already been answered today, but maybe we could broaden that just a little bit before we move on to the next question.
One of the reasons that I have heard the most about the reason for not homeschooling is not all parents have the capability to be able to teach their children. And when you have a group that is starting up that are wanting to have a different type of education from what the public school gives, they have the vision, but they don't quite have the ability to do that. That's when the school comes into focus.
So should the parents be more involved in our schools then?
Yes.
All right, question answered. One thing I also, about homeschooling is the discipline it requires. Going to school does help with that some, where you can have a disciplined environment. But we're not going to talk a lot about that, except to say some of this was covered already, I felt like, with what Gerald said, as well as some of the others. Let's move on to the next question, and that is the very interesting question and debatable question of teacher pay. And I would like to have some discussion on this. We have some time, so let's paint some pictures. So we all agree that we should pay our teachers enough. What we don't agree on always is how much is enough. And teacher pay is perhaps the biggest expense an established school has. I've been watching that in our school since I write the checks, and it is. It's a major expense. So, just to introduce the question. So there's a lot of things we can talk about. Should teachers get less or more than average the wage earner in the community? Kind of a dumb question. So I'll ask it this way. Does teacher pay have anything to do with teacher longevity?
Does pay have anything to do with the rest of our career choices and the longevity?
I think the
obvious answer is yes, it does.
Well, okay, it's not fair that I talk, right? So I'm the guy getting paid. So 80% in the average Christian school budget, I think we should strive for 80% of our budget is teacher pay.
Okay. Probably right.
So if you're at 50 or 60%, you need to really look at your pay for sure. That's based on averages. So it's uncomfortable to talk about this a little bit from my vantage point. Here is, I think I could speak for some of these brothers that I've been talking with that have been in the classroom a while. Men want to do what is valued in the community. Mm-hmm. So it's not just about pay, okay? Mm-hmm. There's more to it than that. So it's the whole real job thing. So we actually want to know that what we're doing is a valuable help. And we are willing to sacrifice some. I don't know of a teacher who doesn't. So it's part of it's the value question. So one of the things I hear sometimes from patrons, man, I had a dad tell me, he said, man, it's just so expensive. Tuition is so expensive. It's just like, man, you guys, you know, probably making all kinds of money. And he wasn't close with the money to know anything, but, you know, I just assumed. Now, this is the same guy that drives remarkably new vehicles, took his family to Hawaii for $16,000, and other things like this. And so, you see, some of that's a value question. It's not just about the dollars and cents for us. It's also about how people talk about it, I guess. That ends up counting. Now, however, that said, it doesn't actually pay the bills.
Right.
So, question, there's been a number of communities that have tried doing things like they actually take the demographics and take all the single women in church and ask them to report their wage. It can be just an anonymous slip of paper that goes to the treasurer or a deacon, actually, often, and they take the average of the single women, okay, for that, and then married men, kind of in that bracket. What can a man be making? And let that help guide the process. So teachers never think they have to make more than everyone else, or if they do, they probably shouldn't be there. Okay, so it's not about that, but we do like to live. We like to feed our families. So I think some of it is we haven't maybe been creative enough. So now I'm not really proud of this, but the truth is, excuse me, we have three vehicles, which is probably excessive. We have quite a few drivers in our family anymore, and so every one of my vehicles has more than 200,000 miles. That actually doesn't bother me. I'm okay with that. I mean, it's nice and they work well, but it's really not. It's am I able to feel like I can support and provide the basics of life and put a little bit away in case of emergency? So, but now let's talk about the creativity part. I think we can think only in salaries, and that might be a bit of a mistake. It's only the salary number. But there's lots of ways. When I was teaching Brian, his family, he's sitting back, he's a former student of mine, his family gave us a half a beef every year. Now you could say, well, that feels like I'm just a charity case. But, you know, we really appreciated it. We have fresh beef that came off their farm, half a beef. That's real dollars. I know of a family that had plenty of money, and they gave a very low interest loan to a male teacher so they could buy a house. So, and that's real money, not even taxable. There are lots of creative ways to make the dollars work better. So I would encourage us to think not when in teacher pay, not only the salary number, but other kinds of compensation. As long as it's not about, well, you poor guy, well, guess we'll have to help you with this. And okay, but it can be things like helping with their medical aid premium, or there's all kinds of ways that the church can kind of kick in. So I think I'm calling for not just looking at the bottom line dollar, because all of us feel badly about how much it costs to run the school, and we know we're a big part of the expense.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other thoughts on that? Does teacher pay have anything to do with teacher longevity?
And if I could just say that, I've talked to a lot of men over the years and women. I'd like to make a comment here, if I could. Four of the six of us in our family teach. So I have three siblings who teach. And one of the things, it does make a difference. When men struggle to make ends meet and then they are really working 60 hours a week and more, it gets really heavy, okay? So it does. I've heard a lot of men say, I just couldn't afford to teach. And I know a couple guys talked to me. They went back into the workforce. They made $60,000 to $80,000 for a few years, went back into teaching. And basically, they bounced back and forth to support their habit, teaching. So there's that. But on the other hand, our single women, I'd like to say something if I could. So I have two older single sisters, and they are as valuable as I am. Their expenses are slightly different, but I'm concerned about them, actually. I helped my oldest sister figure out how to buy a house. She's 50 years old, And I wanted her to have an asset. Many of our women are just making not enough money. And so they can't have the basics. They have a hard time making it work too. So I would encourage this question among board members to be more than just about the men, but also about, what about the people? I personally think that for the first year or two, you can pay a little bit less, figure out what that person's going to be around, what they care about, would they like to be long-term? If they're on a long-term trajectory, we start paying them. And makes enable so they can actually have an asset. So when they're 7 years old, they don't have a husband to take care of them, but they have an asset, something they could sell, something they could that would help them in their latter years of life. I do think we don't talk enough about that.
Okay. Another question. Do current economic factors play a part in determining pay? Let's say all the farmers are suffering from bad commodity prices for a 1 year. This is a short-term thing. Should the teacher's pay go down the next year? Maybe we should have an audience vote or something. Any discussion on that? And let's say it's pretty bad.
Well, you can't pay it if you don't have it. But up until then, if it is in fact one of our most lucrative investments, that's not going to be the first investment we cut.
Okay. Excellent answer. Let's move on. How often should a teacher get paid? I would like to have an audience poll on this one. You can raise your hands. How many of you, and if you don't know, you don't have to raise your hand on anything, but how many of you know or are pretty sure your school pays your teachers once a month? All right, very good. How many of you pay every 2 weeks or bi-monthly? Twice a month. All right, anybody more often than twice a month? All right, anybody less often than a month? Okay, so we're right at either approximately every 2 weeks or every month. That's very interesting. Most of us were a month. Is that often enough? I get paid every 2 weeks where I work.
I would highly recommend paying oftener than once a month. And it's awkward for me to say that, seeing the amount of hands that were raised for paying once a month. There are a lot of expenses that can occur during a one-month period, and there may be times that, as our teachers just don't have enough to make that work. I really think we ought to look at and talk about some of those things.
We pay once a month at our school as well, usually. Not necessarily always. Any other comments on that?
Along with that, I found when I was teaching, there was the beginning of the school term was always a crunch time because you were transitioning from summer job to school teaching. And if you had to wait for that whole month to go by before you got your first paycheck, it could go at least 6 weeks sometimes from your summer job paycheck until you got your first paycheck for teaching. That, when you're already on a limited budget and your family's growing, is very stressful. There's one of the schools that I was teaching in that they paid me every 2 weeks, which actually gave me a full month's extra wages by the end of the school term. And that proved to be very beneficial instead of just bi-monthly. Doing it every 2 weeks, it didn't feel like as big of a burden for them, but it actually gave me a month's extra wages.
Thank you.
Could I mention one more option for you maybe? If you can pay your teachers enough, if you took your 10-month pay, by the way, teachers don't just show up the day before school starts. They always have this little time ahead. If you could think about spreading their payout over 12 months, take a 10-month pay, spread out over 12, makes they could actually live on that. If they can find employment for those 8 weeks or nine, whatever they have in the summer, that's all kind of bonus. That's where, for many years, I made that was my savings I could just live on everything. And the summertime job gave that extra. That all went into savings. So there might be some other creative approaches you might check into just to take that same amount and just keep it going throughout the whole year. And then those transitions when you're moving from teaching into your summertime job and then back out again aren't quite as challenging.
Okay.
Single women especially love that.
Yeah. One question I want to pose with that, since we're on that subject. What about paying? One of the things our school used to do, or at least it's in the handbook, I don't know where it got dropped, but is to pay teachers half of their month, we did monthly, I guess, half their monthly wage during the summer. How many of you do that? Half of the monthly wage during the summer, or some summer pay at all? All right. Fair number. All right. So I guess you kind of answered that question a little bit. Any more comments on the summer pay thing, or maybe if you teach, the idea was if you teach the next year, you get half your salary, basically, is what I think the idea was. For some reason, we're not doing that anymore. I'm not sure why. Any other comments on that before we move on? Okay. Should a school have a set pay schedule, as in a table of information showing how much pay a teacher gets based on years of experience, other factors, and try not to elaborate quite because I have some other sub-questions here. But is it a good idea to have a pay schedule, or should you just kind of, well, we paid the teacher this much last year, so we're going to pay them this much this year? Or should there be a little more of a formal agreement, this is how we're going to do that? What's the advantage or disadvantages of something like that? Any thoughts on that?
When we're writing checks, leaving things open-ended rarely results in generosity. And so I think it's, as a church, it's good for us to make a commitment that this is what we will pay. If we just wing it every year, there might be some years where we're generous, but that's not the gravitational pull.
Okay.
I think we need to set some goals and then meet them. So I would say a structure is a good thing.
And so I heard you say church, so it's not just a school board deciding necessarily. Maybe it could be a church decision, like the parents get involved a little bit.
It's a school board decision. I wasn't choosing my words carefully there, but okay. I suppose it could be discussed, maybe should be, initially anyway.
All right. So let's say that we're starting a new school and need to make a pay schedule. How should a first-year teacher's pay be determined? We've kind of covered this a little bit, but what are some factors, especially in first-year teachers, that we should be thinking about when it comes to pay? If the starting wage in the community, let's say, is to go drive tractor, it's $12 an hour. Should the teacher get paid $12 an hour? Should that kind of be our goal? I realize we touched on this a little bit already. Or should a first-year teacher get paid, let's make it $20 an hour. I mean, salary, but 20. Or should we have them clock in and out? I actually kind of like that idea. I think it'd be interesting.
I think it'd be horrible. Because the overtime wouldn't feel very good. You know, I mean, I can appreciate that, but it does put pressure. I love a salary because I want to do a good job, and some weeks it does take 80 hours. Mm. And a lot of times it better not.
Yeah.
So I can appreciate the overture there, but the bottom line is I would hate to clock in and out. I'd feel like, wow, I don't know how to. So I would say along with that, I think I would agree that a schedule is very helpful, that it shouldn't be entry level. And to consider things like years of experience, mm-hmm. training, You know, we have to be careful with the federal laws as well about paying married men just because they're married. They get paid twice what everyone else does. That's actually not legal. You have to give responsibility in order to pay. You have to have a reason, a rationale for it.
You're saying that's not legal on a federal level?
Yes. My understanding is that the feds have opinions about this.
Okay.
And so state level varies some, but that we want to be a little careful just because the idea there is that if you are, here's the job is to be done, whoever fills it gets this much money. Mm-hmm. So one of the ways we've gotten around that, of course, is to give responsibility to the married men, for instance, such as principal or lead teacher. And so we actually can and should pay more. That's how we've done it, and I see no issue with that, but just a willy-nilly. I know of a school back east where the guys automatically get, after their second year, they get $5,000 more the next year because, well, they'll probably be starting a family and then get married the next 5 years. They need to have money. And that's what I think is actually unethical.
Uh-huh.
So I think we need to have some kind of system whereby we can offer this kind of pay. At the same time, we have to factor in situations. So I'm for that too.
Okay. We're going to need to wrap up this question here and move on to the next one soon. There's a few other questions maybe we'll ask, and you can maybe choose if you would like. Should we be doing more to train our teachers and then pay them more? One of the things I think of with a trainee teacher, with a first and second year teacher, if we haven't trained them, there is a side in which they should probably not get paid too much, if that's a problem. But should we be doing more to train them so they are more qualified and therefore maybe paid a little bit more? I also had that question, should marital status be considered? We already talked about that. Should supply and demand come in at all? If you think of jobs and technology right now, for example, are in high demand, so you're going to have a little higher pay. So teacher jobs are actually fairly high demand as well, as you school board members know. Should we be willing to pay more then? Anyway, those are some questions that I fear we don't have time to answer, but maybe somebody has some wrap-up discussion on that yet before we go on to the next question.
The question here about should a first and second year teacher be considered a trainee? The short answer would be no. The longer explanation would be that I think we should be doing more, not only in training them before, but while they're teaching, to have a goal to make this work for them. And be willing to pay them, even if, let's say, they are learning how to teach, while they're teaching. I think our goal should be to make them feel valuable, to help them achieve the results that the school board and the church desires. Then we can't say they're a trainee. They are learning the ropes, and they're getting experience that they're going to need down the road. So the short answer would be no, but the longer answer would be let's make them worth it. Let's help them through and make sure that they grow into the job. Marital status, if we're paying our single people so very little, then once they're married, yes, it should make a difference. We should pay them more. But I think even for our single brethren and sisters as well, we should make it worth they're worth the money that we pay them. Probably more.
All right. Very good. Thank you very much for that. Moving on to the next question, I'd like to talk a little bit about a school handbook. How many of you schools have a school handbook? Raise high. So we have maybe 50%? 60? Yeah, I'm not sure. Kind of hard to count that fast. All right. Let's quickly answer this question. If you would give just a short answer, what is the purpose of having a handbook? Could you just explain to us who might not have one, what is the purpose of a handbook? Or even to us who do have them, do we really need to have them? Just give me a couple purposes. Something that comes to your mind.
It saves a lot of rehashing.
Okay, figuring things out every year. All right, anything else?
It provides clear communication that is understood by board, parents, students, and teachers.
Okay. Anything else? How often should a school handbook be updated? How many of you have a set plan to update your school handbook within the next 5 years? Not very many. All right. So, should we have a plan to update our school handbook, or should we make it as it was made in 2019? It should be good for at least another 30 years.
Our school board school handbook has been updated multiple times within the last 5 years.
And it's not that you have a specific plan for that, it's just you have a process in place maybe that would make that happen. Okay.
It seems to me that the necessity for updating the school handbook will largely depend on how thick it is.
Yeah.
If it's real thin, it probably don't need to be updated that much. How thin or thick should it be? It should probably be thick enough to where it needs to be updated more than once every 30 years. I spend most of my time thinking about this question from a church perspective.
Yeah.
And so I think in those terms a little more. And I think that it needs to be, the short answer is as needed.
Okay.
But if our handbooks are what they are relevant, are doing anything, the world we live in moves fast enough, they probably need to be updated fairly often if they're doing their job.
Thank you.
I think it's helpful if the handbook itself states that it will be updated every 5 years. It might be oftener, but at the least. And what that means is actually going through that handbook and thinking carefully about what it actually says. And if this is how things are, it's back to Malin's point. It is very difficult, as a principal, it's very difficult to actually update ours every year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so because I find it very difficult to have things in the handbook that we don't actually do or ignore or do more than what it says. And then students, that are the ones who are astute, will definitely be looking at the handbook, hey, what about this? You know, yeah, what about that, right? And so in terms of making the school work, it's really helpful when it actually reflects reality, not ideals.
Mm-hmm. So can I ask another question then? Should the board or the teacher be able to make exceptions to the school handbook sometimes? Again, it's probably going to depend how thick or thin it is, but any thoughts on that? Any of you? Let's say it says no chewing gum in the classroom, and the teacher decides, today we're going to chew gum in the classroom.
The handbook is made to avoid those kind of situations. So they know what is expected and they plan to abide by it. And that goes to more than just the teacher. That goes as well to the board members, to the ministry of the congregation.
Okay.
I think there should be a procedure to this thing is more than just about the school. I think there should be a procedure set in place by the handbook that states how this will be done.
Okay.
Another question along that line, when you update it, or who updates it every 5 years, and does it need to be ratified by who? And
mm-hmm.
For some churches, like one brother in my church said, if we got to get the whole church on here, we'll spend several brethren's meeting voting on the stationery.
Okay, can I respond to that? So that's an excellent question. You have the answer, I think, in your head already, But I think this is maybe a good time to just say that it is worth doing a good job writing that handbook with the right amount of little stuff in it. Mm-hmm. There's some things that the lead teacher can take care of and make work. If you get too granular, that's where you run into trouble. Mm-hmm. It's so minute, but it should give basic direction, basic policies that we run by that gets interpreted by the principal, and where there's question or a little bit of gray, that's where the board comes in and says, how do you want to do this? Mm-hmm. So I think the church votes in the board members to do the work of changing the handbook if necessary. However, I like when the church has an opportunity to make comment before it's ratified.
I agree. So maybe the board could be responsible or assign someone to be responsible. The church would have some opportunity to have some input, some comment, and that way everybody kind of has a chance to say something.
Okay, so I'm sorry, one more thing.
Yes.
So as a principal too, the other thing that I really like when it happens is when there is space given to make the call that is a little bit different, maybe exactly how it is, and then there's that clear communication and accountability. However, here's where the board doesn't know all the nuances. They're not in the classroom. So I think it's really helpful when you update your handbook to, can you incorporate the lead teacher or the principal into that discussion? They can go through and tell you, well, here's where we don't do this, we don't do this, we do this. If you can incorporate them, that really builds something of trust and of working together that I think is really healthy in making up a good school handbook.
Thank you. I think in our last 5 or so minutes, we will go on to another point, and that is extracurricular activities. And I know, Gerald, you covered this some. Did you have one more thing? Go ahead.
Gerald's comment in relation to the trust that goes into that with our teachers, and if that trust isn't there, you're going to need a lot more than just a handbook.
Thank you. So we spend a lot of time teaching the traditional school subjects, and the question is, and maybe was sort of answered already today, but would we do the church and community a service to be more focused on extra subjects like song leading, public speaking, home repair? A vast majority of our students will be living in houses after all, and small engine repair, witnessing even, sewing, that kind of thing, plumbing. How do we focus on those things without getting too involved with them, maybe? We have a few minutes. What do you have?
Well, my first thought is this ties directly or is extremely impacted by the question of career teachers, because a first, second, third year teacher is just trying to keep ahead of the curriculum.
That's a good point.
And even the best rookie teacher is not going to be as good as he is 10, 11, 12 years in. And so that curriculum becomes something that he can do, and he has the mental resources and just the space in his head to think about extracurricular things.
All right. James, did you have something on that?
There's one of our teachers that we've had in the past that all the students that came from his classroom are excellent public speakers. And the reason for that is because he incorporated public speaking into geography for one of them. He did a class, they studied a geographical area, and they had to do a class presentation on that particular area. And in that whole thing, he was grading them on their public speaking. A very simple way of doing it. But those particular students that come out of his classroom far outshine the ones that did not come through his classroom in their public speaking abilities.
So you're saying we could find ways of incorporating this and still learn the basic subjects?
Absolutely.
That's an excellent, excellent point.
So butchering chickens can be done in a geography class too, when you're talking about a certain culture and the way they process meat. I mean, you could butcher chickens as what you do. It doesn't have to be a class.
Right.
And I think what you're saying is right on. We can integrate all that. You want children to become writers? Critique their writing. Help them become better writers in what they're already writing. Mm-hmm. Rather than adding, piling on, incorporate. I think that's just well said, James.
Make seat cushions for this class in art project. Gives them chance to sew. Even the boys can do that. And they like to sit on them better.
All right.
If I could say one more thing on that, maybe too. In our community, some of you would do really well taking students for a day and teaching them a particular skill. Mm-hmm. Every year, we end up doing a life skills week. We don't do any academics for 1 week, and then we split up students in different groups in grades 9 to 12. And we had an appliance repairman in our one of our patrons, and he teaches them, how would you fix a washer that's going clunk, clunk, clunk? And they tear apart a washer. Here's the issues you got to look for. Here's what it would take. We've done plumbing and wire up a little building. Those are all things that can take just a day or two. Gives them a picture of what it takes. It's not like it's mastery, but it's some good exposure. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to. I agree. We don't want to overshadow everything else, but it can be incorporated in little bits and pieces.
I can see where I would have benefited from some of that. Yep. All right. Anything else before we move on to just a couple other points? We're going to give ourselves another 5 minutes yet. So. Do you have anything else you would like to say on extracurricular activities? Maybe specifically, do you have some that should be especially important to us, maybe? Can you give me maybe the top five? I mean, should we really be teaching everybody to sew? Should we have, for the older students, a witnessing class or something? Or not a witnessing class, but maybe that could be integrated into geography or... what would be some of the important ones, maybe just quickly, that you would think of as being maybe a little more important? We mentioned a couple, maybe.
I think the number one question that should be asked to help us figure out those is, does this promote the kingdom of God?
Okay. So we could start out by asking the question, does this promote the kingdom of God? I like that. Anything else? All right. We had a couple that I would have probably would be, one would be song leading, especially for the men. Public speaking, I think, is another one, being able to clearly tell somebody something. Home repair could be useful, and there would be, I'm sure, others. But it's not just, it's something, it is true that the parents can teach some of that too. And so I think we as schools need to be careful about just trying to do that all ourselves. Maybe we can involve the parents, as was mentioned. Parents could be involved, and maybe you could have them come in and help you fix something or make something. All right, let's cover one more question, and I have a couple options here. I think we'll go with the communication one. So today we have various ways of communicating. We can text, we can email, we can have phone conversations, we can be face-to-face. When a board is talking about an issue or calling a meeting, what is the best way to communicate? Should it just be a text message, email? What are some guidelines for communication among a board or among board to teacher?
I think it's best if you're trying to figure out what the schedules are and when it would suit, electronic communication would be fine, whether it be texting or emailing. But when it comes to discussing issues, it might even be good to have, you know, if the agenda can even be sent electronically. But when it comes to discussing issues, there's no substitute to face-to-face.
So you're saying you shouldn't administer teacher discipline via text message?
That's correct.
All right. I hope we knew that already. So in communicating, we talked a little bit about an agenda. I would like to do an audience poll. How many of you board members actually have a written agenda before the meeting available to all the board members. Generally speaking, at least. Okay. I know some of that could depend a little bit on the size of the school, to how important that is, maybe. Is that true? James, do you think that if your school is 10 pupils, it's not as important to have an agenda?
Still important to have an agenda. Depends how long ahead of time. If it's, you know, like a minute before the meeting starts, that could be fine on that one.
And there's no problems or something. I'm asking a question.
This thing of not having an agenda, I'm reminded of a bumper sticker that said, "I don't know where I'm going, but I sure am making time."
Go ahead.
We do have an agenda for the board meeting, and we've had for a long time. But as far as having it before the board meeting actually starts, we very seldom have that before the board meeting starts. But it has been working well for us.
Okay. I think it could depend a little bit on what you're facing at the moment, some, at least in my perspective. All right, we need to wrap things up. Time is up. Thank you very much for participating in this. And hopefully it was helpful to give you all and me some ideas for our school year that's in progress now. And one thing I would like to say yet, that is if you have any suggestions for next year's PSLI, for the panel discussion in particular, be sure to write those down on your sheets that you hand in on the poll, or whatever we're calling it, the sheets that you can hand in some information, what you thought about the Institute this year. Feel free to suggest some more topics. Thank you, brethren, for your help. You are dismissed, and we'll turn the time over to the next person.